You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
And it should come as no surprise to anyone that given the latest developments, we are coming very close to triggering Article 7.
The European Commission threatens Poland with sanctions, but does this illustrate the EU's omnipotence or impotence? My guests Linda Yu and Matthew Green will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including what presenter salaries at the BBC might tell us about the gender pay gap everywhere, whether the end of the battle for Mosul might just be the start of another fight with Islamic State, and the failure of Sino-American trade talks, the United States' loss or China's. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Linda Yu, the economist and broadcaster, and Matthew Green, journalist and author, most recently of Aftershock. Welcome both. And we will start tonight with Poland, which appears on the verge of being sin-binned by the European Commission. EC panjandrums are toying with invoking the feared Article 7, a sanction which can include the suspension of a member nation's voting rights. Poland has tempted the wrath of the EC, and in fairness, of all persons with an interest in the rule of law, with a plan to effectively bring its judiciary under government control. Linda, first of all, it probably won't actually happen because everybody in the EU would have to agree on it. And frankly, what are the chances of that? I mean, and also Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban has already said that he wouldn't go along with it. But should it? Do Poland deserve a bit of a slap?
I think the question is, can they do something short of the so-called nuclear option, which is the dramatic
language? Well, that would seem an overreaction.
Well, that's what Article 7 is actually described as, which is the suspension of voting rights. It's actually a very good test case. The European Commission has never actually come across a member state who is violating one of the freedoms that the European Commission says is sacrosanct to a democracy, which is having an independent judiciary and the rule of law. And the last couple of hours, Poland actually passed that legislation, which would mean that all Supreme Court judges would actually have to be appointed by the legislature. So they've essentially said to the EC, you've threatened this, you gave us a week to work it out. And by the way, we're still going to go ahead and do this because this is within our sovereignty. And so I think it brings an interesting issue into stark relief, which is a nation sovereignty and the European Commission increasingly having a supranational oversight over of nations. And I think that's essentially what this represents. I mean, to be completely, I think, historical about it, obviously, a lot of these new accession states were ex-transition economies. Poland is the largest one. And adopting democratic principles is what they did after they shed their communist regimes in the early 1990s. And actually, to join the European Union, to become democratic, was actually one way of bringing all of these nations towards a common path. And so this is not something superimposed from the outside. This is actually something which is actually fairly integral to the way the European Union is supposed to work.
I do want to talk about what this does actually mean for Poland, because as you point out, Linda, it is a fairly major and extraordinary and indeed alarming step. But Matthew, that sort of supranational authority there from the EC slash EU was something that we were hearing a fair bit about in this country a little over a year ago for one reason or another. Are we learning here from the Polish example that in fact you can have your cake and eat it, that you can just go ahead and ignore any EC or EU directives if they don't actually suit you?
Well, I wonder when the money will start to talk in this debate, because obviously Poland receives a pretty large share of the EU structural funds or aid budget. And my question would be when that starts to come into play and the powers that be in the European Commission decide to make their displeasure felt through financial means.
But what actual recourse do you think the EU does have in dealing with a member state that does, you know, go rogue in this sense?
Yeah, it is a good question, actually, because it hasn't happened before, has it?
Article 7 has never been invoked.
Unless you define going rogue by just deciding to leave. A sort of epic act of self-harm. I mean, I'd be really interested to see whether the EU decides that actually, in the wake of Brexit, or the EC anyway, does need to bear a few more teeth, actually, in this case. Poland isn't like Britain. Poland really wanted to be in the EU, right? I mean, this was always a huge national project, and it's part of the national consensus that the EU is a good thing and has brought enormous benefits. And there are thousands of people protesting on a daily basis against the Justice and Law Party for taking these steps in terms of asserting political control over the judiciary. So I wonder whether actually the European Commission may have a little bit more leverage than we realise.
Linda, it's a tricky one for the EU stroke EC this though, isn't it? Because as they certainly learnt last summer here, not that they, I suspect, needed instruction, the one obvious recourse that every populist politician or party in Europe has, when in doubt, beat up on the EU and the EC. Or the EU especially, we'll call the EU the short shorthand for everything else, but you beat up on the EU. You say it's bureaucratic, it's sclerotic, it meddles, it thinks it knows better, etc., 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 etc. If the EC does come down on Poland like a ton of bricks, it just gives the Justice and Law Party exactly that option, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I think we do have to think, what are the next steps? So say they suspend Poland from voting in the European matters. Would Poland retaliate by threatening a Brexit?
Is that what we would call it? There must be a better Polish pun than that. I'm going to walk on it. Work on it. That was me trying to do a Warsaw walk. No, it's not. It's going nowhere. Sorry,
so
do
basically,
carry on.
I think we'll stick with Brexit. I've dubbed it. We'll timestamp this. But I mean, that's essentially the end game, right? And would Poland do that? I'm not sure they will. As I say, I think the appeal to join the EU was a big part of leaving the communist ex-Soviet Union kind of sphere. But on the other hand, it is essentially saying to the European Commission, what are you going to do if you suspend our voting rights? You know, what are they just, will they just ignore the EU? And to me, it's not clear that this is something that's going to have a definitive end, as in the EC says, we suspend your vote. The Polish say, well, actually, we don't want to be part of a body that won't allow us to vote interfering in our national affairs, so we're going to leave. I don't actually see that scenario. I see much more of a muddling through scenario. The European Commission will try to slap their wrist, probably doing something, maybe suspend part of their voting rights. The Polish will say, well, we need to discuss what rule of law actually means. Do you know all these studies that define the effective rule of law is different from the actual rule of law? And I suspect some type of muddling through. But it is, in many ways, the kind of test case that will presage other cases as countries start to test the boundaries of what is European Union level supervision and what should be remaining within the realm of sovereign nations.
So no call for crack off or the last Gdansk. None of those are really going anywhere. Matthew, I do want to talk, though, about, as you said, these countries in Eastern Europe, former Warsaw Pact especially, wanted very much to join the EU, at which point, you know, it was fairly clear what the sort of organisation the EU was, a fraternity of liberal democracies, etc., etc. Is it weird that it has been the Eastern European countries, especially Poland and obviously especially Hungary, which have shown the most authoritarian inclinations since joining the club?
Well, given their respective histories, maybe not so strange. But I think what is really interesting is that actually the kind of rhetoric that we're hearing from both Hungary and Poland is that they do want to be part of Europe, but they don't want it to be a two-tier Europe. They want to be front and centre of deciding what sort of character this bloc has. And they're almost casting themselves in the role of the kind of, or trying to cast themselves in the role as the elder statesman telling the French and the Germans in the centre what will and what will not stand in terms of how this enterprise is going to go forward. Whether they're going to actually have their voice heard, though, I think we're going to have to wait and see, aren't we?
Okay, well, let's take a look now at the UK, where for the last 24 hours or so, media outlets with a professional interest in beating up on the BBC have been pretending to be furious that certain of the BBC's best-known stars get paid what are certainly decent wages for public sector employees. Leaving aside any questions of whether presenter X deserves amount Y, however, it was unmistakable that for some BBC employees, i.e. the men, the wages seem to be markedly more different, or generous rather, than for other BBC employees, i.e. the women. Linda, I mean, it's an extreme example, the BBC, because the wages paid to BBC megastars are not like wages paid to most people. So in this particular instance, before we look at the broader subject, is there a gender pay gap going on at the BBC, or do some BBC stars just have better agents than others?
I think we're probably not getting the full picture in terms of what's being reported. So, for instance, if you work for BBC World, the commercial arm, or you're paid through an independent production company, I think those are not part of the disclosure. The disclosure is only if you're paid via the license fee. So I'm not suggesting the picture might be dramatically different. What I'm suggesting is that it is a partial picture. And the other thing you don't know is you don't actually know what they do for the money that they receive. So, for instance, people present various programs. Some do telly, some do radio. Others also do current affairs, documentaries. So there's also an unclear, it's not earnings per hour. And so I think that's why it's hard to comment on the specific cases. But I think the general picture of the gender pay gap, it's unsurprising it's an issue for the BBC. It's a big issue, well, pretty much everywhere.
Well, indeed it is. But I'm just wondering, in this particular instance, though, there has been a row over the gender pay gap. Mm-hmm. But does having that argument or that discussion over this particular instance actually hinder the wider argument? Because it has been pointed out, I guess not unreasonably, that Claire Balding, who is a very well-known, very well-respected mm-hmm. sports presenter, gets paid something around a tenth of what Gary Lineker gets paid for doing a broadly similar job, mm-hmm. which seems unfair. But a lot of people are going to answer that by saying that they could live quite happily on a tenth of mm-hmm. Gary Lineker's wages.
And I think most people would. Isn't he on...
About a little over $1 million a year, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm going to say, yeah, I think he could very comfortably on a very small...
Most of us would struggle by on a tenth of that. But does that make this an unhelpful example to be having this discussion about?
I think any news peg that opens the debate is helpful. I mean, I think there are probably multiple layers here, right? So you've got the gender issue, you've got the BAME issue, ethnic minorities, obviously. There's another pay gap there. There's also the issue of the license fee generally. They've also disclosed all fair talent. So what I'm suggesting is, no, the BBC is obviously not a typical example. Presenters are not typical of normal people. However, opening the debate and looking at all these dimensions, I actually don't think is a bad thing.
Matthew, from next year, all British companies with more than 250 employees will have to publish statistics about gender pay gaps that may exist in their organisation. Is there an argument for greater transparency, I guess, somewhere between what we have now and the extreme example of somewhere like Norway, I believe, which just puts everybody's tax returns online so you can look up what anybody makes. Does that actually help, or are there some countries, like, for example, Britain, where it just provides an endless arena for rancorous resentments, bitterness, rage, jealousy,
backstabbing,
etc.?
Yeah, well, I think you were quite right in your introduction to make the point that some of these newspapers are rather enjoying this all a little bit too much at the BBC's expense, aren't they? But on the other hand, it is a huge issue, and it's not just in the BBC, it's across the board that women are getting paid less at almost all levels, and there's lots of reasons for that. Sometimes they take breaks, or of course, for family reasons and so forth, but actually, when you control for all of that, it turns out that for some inexplicable reason, women are paid about 20% less, I think, on average, than men.
And pretty close. 18.1, it says here.
That's obviously got to be something that we address as a matter of urgency. It can't be good for anyone in society for us to be kind of rolling along in this kind of lopsided manner.
Well, this is exactly it. You say a matter of urgency, and it is something that just, I think, would strike any reasonable person as self-evidently outrageous. But Linda, it has been the law in this country for 47 years that you have to pay women the same that you would pay men to do a particular job, quite reasonably. So for 47 years, this has been seen as not just the reasonable thing to do, but actually legally necessary to do. And yet that gap still exists. It's 18.1%, which is and that's literally not small change. Why is there still such an issue?
I think information and transparency are part of the reasons, which is why I think the BBC case is good, because you do actually get more information. So for a lot of people who work in a company, it's not clear. Like, do you know what you make, Andrew, versus, say, a colleague? You know, most companies, it's not transparent. And I think that makes it harder to enforce legislation on equal pay. And I think some of the – and also, I mean, there's also – it's not just information, I should stress. I think there are difficulties for women asking for pay rises. The whole idea of doing so, you know, is harder for women. They've been told to lean in by the likes of Sheryl Sandberg. So I think there is a deep-rooted set of reasons why it is we haven't been able to budge on this. But I think the dramatic thing to do would be to do what Norway does, which is just to make everybody's pay much more transparent.
It is really in Norway, I'm fascinated by this. Literally everyone's tax return is online.
Yeah.
So any Norwegian, you're sitting in an office, you know exactly, if you want to, what all of your co-workers are being paid relative to you. That's incredible. Well, I think that would be very refreshing. I mean, it's such a taboo subject, isn't it, in the UK?
It is in this country. I've not spent that much time in Norway. I can't claim to know Norwegians well, but they are. And apologies to any of our Norwegian listeners for my imminent generalizations, but they are a stolid and practical people.
I just think I can see this
leading to murders in this country.
I think the way we're going in this country at the moment, on almost every indicator, we should be doing everything differently. So if Norway has some kind of radical suggestion, we should wholeheartedly embrace it.
Well, actually, one of the interesting things was they changed the way you can read other people's tax returns in Norway. So originally, you could go and do it kind of surreptitiously. But now, if you go and you look at somebody's tax return, you have to, it's recorded that you have looked.
Ooh,
and it's
interesting.
Actually, it's changed the dynamics a bit.
Has Norway not descended into civil war?
Well, it's sort of like the social media era, right? So if your footprint is there, but you might be more careful about
I was thinking about that exact point. If it was possible on Facebook for it to be recorded who had looked at whose pages, nobody would ever use it ever again.
That's exactly the principle I was thinking of.
It is extra. I just want to pick up finally, Linda, that point you made about part of the problem being women being perhaps less assertive and less willing to speak up for themselves. That was actually something suggested by Gary Lineker's agent, John Holmes. And there's somebody who's having a good week. lot of new business for him, I reckon. But he said a lot of female stars preferred to work with female agents who he suggested might be less assertive.
Yeah, I raised that because I think it's not the entire explanation, obviously. Leaning in is not the entire explanation. Some of it is just bias. I think we just have to be frank. It could be unconscious bias, what it is that is offered to a woman versus a man. Your starting point is lower. Your progression, no matter how much you progress, you're always going to be somewhat behind. Literally, there are tons of explanations for why it is the gender pay gap still exists. What is inexplicable is why it is we've actually made very little progress, I think, in terms of what can be done, which is the transparency, the data, this kind of stuff can be changed fairly quickly. The cultural stuff I'm describing is much harder to change, but we know that after all of these decades, women are not just underpaid for the same job with the same skills, they get promoted less, they are underrepresented at the heads of companies. I mean, it's a lot of work to do.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Linda Yu and Matthew Green. Coming up next, is defeating Islamic State really as simple as defeating Islamic State?
Gotland, an isolated Swedish island in the middle of the Baltic Sea, has more to it than meets the eye. Monocle Films lands on Gotland to see how the flare-up in the Baltic region has seen tensions rising in Sweden.
My impression is that the Baltic states feel more of pressure from the Russian side. We have espionage in Sweden. We work with it all the time, and it's very important for Sweden to have capability to defend our democracy.
Out on the film pages of Monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Mullister. With me are Linda Yu and Matthew Green. Now, the recapture of Mosul, Iraq's second largest city, from the militants of Islamic State is obviously good news. A number of informed voices inside and outside Iraq, however, worry that it might be a bit soon yet to celebrate. Aside from the gloomy prospect that civilian casualties of the battle for the city might turn out to be much worse than anticipated, there is the unlikelihood on form that Islamic State will either surrender or desist. Matthew, obviously Mosul had to be retaken by Iraq at some point, but does Iraq now need to brace itself for further difficulty with Islamic State?
I think it absolutely does. The deep structural roots which allowed what was essentially an al-Qaeda insurgency during the time of the US occupation to kind of morph into Islamic State is still very much there. The sectarian divides, the lack of governance, and the meddling by all kinds of foreign actors will continue. So I think absolutely certain that we're going to see a low-level insurgency to rumble on, in the phrase that journalists always like to use.
Linda, can we at least hope that recruitment might become a little bit more difficult for them? Recruitment, financing, etc., now that they're not seen as a territorial entity and now perhaps that they are seen as in retreat?
I would say yes, except there are signs that they may well change their tactics. So I think at the moment, it's a blend of insurgency and guerrilla warfare. But if you look over history, there have been about 200 insurgency type of campaigns since World War II. And a lot of them, after a major defeat, essentially become dominated by undertaking guerrilla warfare. So that includes a few elements. One is they need a sanctuary. So that actually means co-opting the local population instead of essentially demolishing them, which has happened in some of the cases in Iraq. It also requires having a political cause so they could continue their recruitment. And I think that's probably where I would suggest that they may well change their tactics. We already see ideology playing a huge role anyways, but could they do more to co-opt the local population? The answer is I don't know, but I think guerrilla warfare is probably now what we should expect in Iraq.
Matthew, do we need to worry more, not about, or think more at least, not about the fact that Mosul has been retaken, but the fact that it was taken in the first place and held for 3 years by a relatively small number of fairly lightly armed militants? And this is a city by some estimations the size of Birmingham. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a small village they held on to. The point being that an urban centre potentially could it not be exactly the sanctuary Linda describes, partly because Western air forces are going to be more reluctant to drop enormous, you know, destructive explosives on a populated city than they would be on an Afghan mountain range or a Peruvian jungle or whatever you're having yourself?
Yeah, and actually you make an excellent point by rewinding 3 years, because I certainly was amazed when Islamic State raised its flag almost out of nowhere, it seemed.
People who report on Iraq for a living were astonished.
Exactly. We'd kind of forgotten about Iraq. The focus at that time actually was much more on Afghanistan. It was the height of the Obama administration's troop surge. So, yes, it was absolutely amazing and really a commentary on the fundamental weakness of the Iraqi state, both politically but also militarily. Obviously, tens of billions of dollars spent by the US military to train and equip the Iraqi security forces. But at the start of the uprising by Islamic State, they folded very, very quickly and were virtually nowhere to be seen. And it was really the Kurds who were holding the line from their semi-autonomous enclave. So absolutely, the huge questions about the viability and the integrity of the Iraqi state. And now I think the spotlight will have to shift to the political question, because as long as large numbers of Sunnis still feel marginalized under Shiite rule in Iraq, there's going to be tension. There's going to be always room for Islamic State to reemerge in a new form.
OK, well, let's look finally tonight to the United States, where President Donald Trump's oft-stated vow to recalibrate America's trade relationship with China appears to be going approximately as well as his healthcare reforms. Trade talks between the US and China have ended without any agreement or joint statement or shared press conference. Linda, briefly, what appears to have gone wrong here? Well, everything, clearly, but if you could narrow it down a little, that would be good.
Well, I think when you have no statement, a cancelled presser, all of those signs are they could make no real inroads. In a sense, I think the Americans want to reduce the trade deficit with China. China obviously doesn't think that that should be what they should be working on. So in the past, what they gave Donald Trump was essentially a greater, bit more market access into services, for instance, some of the things the Chinese were going to do anyways. And I think the Americans felt that was not going to do much on the trade position. So the Chinese, like the Germans, have never really budged on the fact that they have a trade surplus because they say they're competitive. And my guess is they've completely disagreed on the causes of the trade deficit. And the Americans, including Peter Navarro, perhaps some of Trump's advisors, are still very focused on the exchange rate, the RMB, which the Chinese would never concede. So my guess is they can't decide on the causes of the trade deficit. They're not going to agree on how to address it. And my sense is that the Chinese probably don't think that's the right focus anyways. And they would actually now have probably some support by economists who say focusing on the trade deficit in and of itself is not how you progress trade these days. It's about market opening. It's about making sure investment has a level playing field. All of these things are more 21st century. And so far from the Trump administration, a lot of their trade policy feels a little bit older than that, of an older vintage.
Well, Matthew, Donald Trump has made suggestions at various points of some grand bargain with China, which would link trade agreements with China to Chinese cooperation in dealing with North Korea, if indeed such a thing is possible. Does this tell us anything about that? Is this China basically trying to demonstrate that they're not going to be talked into doing anything they don't really want to do?
I would imagine so. And I mean, since when can we take anything that Donald Trump says seriously on any level?
It is difficult.
I sympathise with the opposition as host of this programme with having to often start a question with something that Donald Trump has uttered.
It is exhausting. I do commend listeners who haven't read it yet to the transcript of his most recent interview with the New York Times, which is...
I try to minimise my exposure to anything with Donald Trump in it, I have to admit, but...
It's quite weird.
In quite long stretches. So the simple answer to your question is I don't know, but I don't think the Chinese know either, and I don't think anybody knows, and probably Donald Trump himself doesn't know.
Is it possible, Linda, that there is then something here of the theatrical flounce by China? Because there has been some progress, as you were suggesting. China has started taking US beef and gas, opening up to US credit card companies. Is there an element of we don't want to look like we're a pushover?
I think Donald Trump, they would view as somebody who respects strongmen. And so I think that would probably mean the Chinese might be slightly more rigid. I mean, the point of these trade talks, I think, really should be about market opening. But as I say, I think they have fundamentally different views on what trade in the 21st century looks like. So I think from Donald Trump's perspective, he's trying to essentially... cater to his electorate, which are all about the Chinese are stealing our jobs, we have massive deficits. He's ordered this massive review of every single country that has a trade deficit with the United States, which, by the way, Britain also has a trade surplus with the United States.
Well, that's something to look forward
to. And so he's going to be coming down hard on these countries. My guess is the Chinese are probably slightly disoriented because that is not what current trade talks are ever really about. Current trade talks, with a few exceptions, are always now about non-tariff barriers, investment, and market access. And it's only at the moment Germany, with a massive trade surplus, that engenders any discussion. And the Chinese are no longer that country. The Chinese current account surplus is less than 2% of GDP. And so they would feel the issue is wrong.
We will have to leave it there. Linda Yu and Matthew Green, thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maya Higard. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. More music next at 1900, The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, and there's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.